Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Today's business travelers are finding that fitting in a little leisure time keeps them recharged and excited on work trips. I know this because whenever I travel for work, I always try and meet up with a friend to catch up, have a great dinner, or hit a museum wherever I am. So if you're traveling for work, go with the card that puts the travel in business travel, the Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card. If you travel, you know. Audible is the home of storytelling, and it lets you enjoy all of your audio entertainment in one app. You'll always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. In fact, I've been really into thrillers and true crime lately, and I just got back from a long car trip where I was listening to the latest zombie Fallout book, Bridging the Gap. And I swear, I had to keep checking the back seat for any glowing eyes as I drove home on that deserted highway. In fact, on so many of my journeys, Audible is there for me with comedy, bestsellers, history, exclusive originals, and more. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/built or text built to 500-500. That's audible.com/built or text built to 500-500. We've all been there. Maybe we used one or two misleading words in a shared document, and then the whole team spends a lot of wasted time trying to get on the same page. But we don't need to make those mistakes. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all of the wasted time and money that goes with it. I spend a lot of time writing. I write scripts, emails, speeches, proposals, you name it. And Grammarly helps me find the right tone. It does so much more than correct grammar. It's almost like a trusted writing partner. And when every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Teams that communicate better with Grammarly report 52% less time spent writing sales emails and 66% less time spent editing marketing content. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Hey, everyone. So I have a request. If you value this show, if you value the stories, the lessons, the wisdom and inspiration we bring to you, if you think of me as your friend, which I am, because even though millions of you are listening, I'm actually talking just to you right now. I need you to be there for me as well, and you can do that by supporting what I do and buying my book, How I Built This. It is just out now and available everywhere, and it doesn't cost more than a few cups of coffee. And it's filled with wisdom and stories and ideas that will have you feeling inspired and fired up to take on the world. So please, if you love this show and what we do for you, do us one back and pick up How I Built This wherever books are sold. Hey, everyone, and welcome to How I Built This Resilience Edition. On these episodes, we're talking with entrepreneurs and other business leaders about how they're meeting this very challenging moment in new and creative ways. And today, we're going to hear from Jennifer Neundorfer. She's the co-founder and managing partner of January Ventures. It's an investment firm focused on tech startups founded by women and people of color. Jennifer joined me to talk about how her company is approaching investment strategies during this unprecedented moment and how they differ from other firms overall.
What we're doing differently is really building a venture firm that is designed around access and transparency. That's not what venture has traditionally been known for. And it's what has really underserved women and underrepresented founders. And so we make it very easy for founders to pitch us and find us. And everything that we do is focused on removing friction for those founders at the earliest stage.
And what type of startups do you look for?
We invest primarily in tech-enabled software businesses. So we are investing in companies that we believe can be high-growth, scalable companies that are going to be capital efficient. We are investing the capital early and then are looking for outsized returns. So we're looking for companies that can go on to be $100 million, billion-dollar companies and really be those outliers that generate returns for our fund.
And you invest in the seed stage, in the early stages of a business?
We invest at the pre-seed and seed stage. And one of the reasons that we do that, Guy, is when we started January, we did some early research. And there had been a lot of data talking about how little venture dollars women receive. In 2019, female-only teams received just 3% of venture dollars. And if a woman happened to have a male co-founder, she received 11% of venture dollars. But what we found in our data, as we look just at the earliest stage, is that there's not only a gender gap, but it really starts early. So for every dollar that a male founder raises at the pre-seed or seed stage, a woman raises 38 cents and a Black woman raises just 2 cents. And so that is really where we are focused at January, because as you can imagine, a dollar versus 38 cents on the dollar versus 2 cents on the dollar, many of those founders are handicapped from the start. And so our focus is on getting them the capital and resources that they need to really generate momentum for their business and get to that scalable growth curve.
How large is your fund right now?
Yeah, we're deploying out of a $20 million fund. You know, we're typically writing checks that range up to, you know, $500,000 plus, because we're investing at a stage when founders are raising, you know, $250,000, $300,000, up to $1 million, at those earliest stages and often the first capital in.
And who are your investors?
Our investors range. So many of them are the typical investors that you would expect to see: family offices, high net worth individuals, and some institutions and foundations. But from the beginning, my partner Marin and I wanted to be very deliberate about who our investors, who our limited partners were, because so much of the traditional venture model has relied on a very small set of investors or limited partners and has reinforced this flywheel around making that small group very wealthy. And so what we have done in both of our funds is proactively reduce the barriers for non-traditional investors to invest in our fund. Whether that is, you know, a founder who is just beginning to accumulate capital and wealth and may not have a lot of liquidity and finding ways for them to participate, or, you know, pitching LPs who fall outside of the traditional circuit that most funds pitch, you know, whether it's by geography, race, ethnicity. We've really tried to work hard to diversify our LP base.
How do you find startups to invest in?
I mentioned that, you know, venture has been so long, really inaccessible to most founders. And a lot of that is because many venture capitalists rely on their network to source deals. And that's fine. But most of the people that are in someone's network look or are similar to, you know, have similar characteristics to that person. We hear a lot of VCs talk about the test. Can a founder get a warm intro to them? And if so, then they're willing to consider taking a meeting. We turned that on our head at January. And so from the day that we launched, we have been open to cold pitches. And when we went out with that, many of our peers told us that we were crazy. We weren't going to see great pitches. There was no way that we could handle that sort of volume. And we were pretty overwhelmed when we launched in October of 2018. We saw 400 pitches within the first week. And so very quickly, we leveraged technology to develop a scalable way to review those deals. We're very generous with the first 30-minute meeting. We want, Marin and I want to be the first people that are meeting these founders, right? We want to be the ones who are judging whether they are a fit for our thesis. And then we have a higher bar for who we spend time with, who we do diligence on, and ultimately invest in. Because the nature of our business is there's a very wide top of funnel. And in any given fund, we're making 25 to 30 investments. So it's a pretty Darwinian process. But we're deliberate in the organizations that we work with to make sure that we are reaching founders that really fit that underrepresented mold and telling them that our light is on and we want to be the fund of choice for them.
So tell me about some of the startups in your portfolio.
Yeah. This is the part that I love talking about. It's sort of like talking about your kids. And it's hard to pick just one, but I'll give you, you know, a sense for some of them. We are investing in problems that we believe are big and we really care about solving. We're really focused on investing in companies that are addressing big, broad problems that are going to shape the future. And so One of those founders that is really doing this is a founder, Julia Collins, who is the CEO of a company called Planet Forward. Julia is a founder who has deep roots in both food and sustainability and, you know, great founder market fit. That's something that we look for a lot. And Julia is building a regenerative supply chain for sustainable foods.
And can I just quickly ask you, sorry.
Yeah.
Can you kind of explain just in plain language, what does a regenerative supply chain mean? I mean, I know what a supply chain means. I know what regenerative means.
Yeah. That's a great question, Guy. It's really about the ingredients and where brands and, you know, and CPG companies are sourcing the ingredients for their foods. And they would basically evaluate the sustainability and, you know, on a number of different metrics, including the carbon footprint, including how those ingredients were actually farmed, and then be able to suggest alternative sources and alternate, whether it's, you know, a different farmer, a different type of ingredient that will have the same impact, so that I, as a brand, could make those adjustments and make a more sustainable and regenerative food product.
Right. So if you were looking for palm oil, for example, this platform could say, hey, you know, this is a better place to source your palm oil from.
That's exactly right.
Right.
And they are really the first ones to do that. And what we've seen in the past 6 months is that consumers, you know, between being at home and suddenly really caring about what food they eat, and then all of the very visible events in the last, you know, couple months around climate change, consumers are really starting to there's an acceleration in consumers' awareness of climate-friendly foods and, you know, being conscious of the choices that they make and wanting those to be sustainable.
Got it.
One other company that I'll highlight is a company called Kinside, a founder, Shadia Segala, who is a repeat founder. And with Kinside, the problem that she's solving is how employers and employees find childcare. And I mentioned Shadia because she's an amazingly charismatic entrepreneur. She's a great leader. She had built a great company. But we got to March and the world shut down. And suddenly no one was sending their kids anywhere. Everyone was locked at home. And so for this moment, you know, it suddenly a lot of her business was in question. And like many of our founders, Shadia saw the long-term opportunity and this looming childcare crisis that is on the horizon of parents not being able to get back to work because either they can't send their children in person or all of these childcare providers, many of them have gone out of business. She's really become a thought leader and is started, you know, during COVID while people were locked at home, laid the foundation for now what the business is doing is getting employees back to work and making sure that parents can find childcare, even if it's not where they were sending their child prior to the pandemic.
Are you seeing, I mean, there are has been a lot of momentum. I don't know if it's real or not, but there certainly have been some VC firms that have announced more support for Black and Latinx startup founders, and Andreessen Horowitz announced a fund, and it's unclear what that will mean. But is it, I mean, are you finding lots and lots of Black and Latinx and other founders of color coming to you with ideas? Is there a real kind of surge in new ideas coming from founders of color?
Guy, I would say that supply of Black, Latinx, LGBTQ, that supply has always been there. And so for us, it's not that we're suddenly seeing a new surge now. I think that we are seeing, at sort of the industry level, that it is a conversation that more people are having. So there's more visibility around the conversation. But, you know, this taps into our whole belief for starting January. Those founders have always been there. You know, so much of what we are doing is trying to make venture accessible to those founders, because for so long, it hasn't been. And if their names become synonymous with the Bill Gates and the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, you know, that's when we will know that we have been successful.
When we come back in just a moment, more of my conversation with Jennifer Neuendorfer and why many entrepreneurs don't want to take venture capital. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This Resilience Edition from NPR. Successful companies don't happen overnight. It takes an awful lot of grit, determination, and teamwork. Our sponsor, Atlassian, knows this better than anyone. Their team has spent over 20 years creating software that powers collaboration for teams around the world. By creating software like Jira and Confluence to improve companies' workflow, Atlassian is on a mission to make impossibility a reality. And now, they're ushering in the next era of teamwork with Atlassian Intelligence. When you think of AI, pizza may not be the first thing that comes to mind. But global pizza chains are actually using AI to scan their pies and make sure they meet their quality standards. From space exploration to making pizza to producing podcasts like the one you're listening to right now, Atlassian thinks there's a lot about AI that companies should be excited about. Atlassian Intelligence transforms teamwork by empowering AI-human collaboration. Atlassian's AI-powered software can help you glean new insights from your data, boost individual productivity by eliminating menial tasks, and help your team make faster, more informed decisions to produce the best results for your customers. And the best part? With Atlassian Intelligence in your corner, you can trust that your work is protected and kept confidential. This isn't just a small step. It's a giant leap in accelerating work. Atlassian AI-powered software like Jira and Confluence help teams accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. Learn how Atlassian AI can help power high-performing teams at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. As a business-to-business marketer, your needs are unique. B2B buying cycles are long, and your customers face incredibly complex decisions. Isn't it time you had a marketing platform built specifically for you? LinkedIn Ads empowers marketers with solutions for you and your customers. LinkedIn Ads allow you to build the right relationships, drive results, and reach your customers in a respectful environment. You'll be able to drive results with targeting and measurement tools built specifically for B2B. In technology, LinkedIn generated 2 to 5 times higher return on ad spend than other social media platforms. I've talked to hundreds of founders and business leaders every day on this show, and I've learned that LinkedIn has been vital to the growth of their companies. It helps them build relationships with customers and get direct access to thousands of decision makers. Make B2B marketing everything it can be and get a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/builtthis to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/builtthis. Terms and conditions apply. We've all been there. Maybe we used 1 or 2 misleading words in a shared document, and then the whole team spends a lot of wasted time trying to get on the same page. But we don't need to make those mistakes. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all of the wasted time and money that goes with it. I spend a lot of time writing. I write scripts, emails, speeches, proposals, you name it. And Grammarly helps me find the right tone. It does so much more than correct grammar. It's almost like a trusted writing partner. And when every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Teams that communicate better with Grammarly report 52% less time spent writing sales emails and 66% less time spent editing marketing content. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This Resilience Edition. So venture capital can be a lifeline for some companies, but if you listen to a lot of our How I Built This episodes, you'll hear many founders tell me they regret taking venture capital money at all, and others saying that they're glad they avoided it. So when I spoke to Jennifer Neundorfer of January Ventures, I asked her about the criticisms VCs often get. And the knock that I hear on the show from so many founders who didn't take VC money is that, you know, VCs expect a 10x return within 10 years, and it forces entrepreneurs to focus on scale and only scale. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
In some cases, yes. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about a lot is venture capital is not right for every business, and not every founder should feel like they have to go out and raise outside capital. And I think my main piece of advice to founders, and a conversation that I always have with founders as part of meeting them, is aligning the incentives of the capital with the vision and motivation of the founder. There is nothing worse, and many of your guests have talked about it, than having friction and having those incentives be at odds. Because the reality is, you're right, the venture model requires a really high return threshold. This is, you know, a risky asset class. And so investors and, you know, RLPs expect a huge return. So I do think that is the right question for founders to ask themselves out of the gate. But I think the second question, if founders are interested in venture capital, is to really do the diligence on the fund and the partner who is leading that deal. Because there's just a wide variety of outcomes that funds are shooting towards, and stylistic differences between partners. And so that, you know, we always encourage our founders to do diligence on us, because that really will make or break the quality of that experience. And I think will shape how the founder feels on the flip side of having taken venture money.
Jennifer, do you think, I mean, I get asked this question a lot, and I have my answer to this question. We're in the middle of a global pandemic and an economic crisis. And I think something like 50% of the Fortune 500 companies started during economic downturns. Do you think now is a good time to start a business?
I think that there will be great companies that are born out of the constraints of this moment. And we've seen that historically. I think that will happen again. But that said, it doesn't make it any easier for prospective founders to make the leap, because the reality is it's actually quite hard to raise money right now. So right after COVID hit in April, we did a survey of our early stage founders. We talked to 250 early stage founders in our community, and it was interesting. 50% felt that COVID would negatively impact their business, but 50% had already pivoted, which just speaks to the nimbleness of early stage founders and the fact that in a certain sense, COVID has put everyone back at the starting line and sort of reset the opportunities for early stage startups. But the more interesting point, Guy, was that 70% of the founders said their experience was that funding opportunities were drying up. And so with that context, it's very easy for, you know, venture capitalists like me to sit here and say, now's the time to build, go out, great companies are going to be born. But as a founder, considering making that leap, that's a scary environment to just leap right into. And so, you know, our response to that was to launch new initiatives to really make it easy for founders to fundraise at scale. One of the things we did and continue to do is an event called Pitch Collective. We have all these inbound cold pitches, right, where we're meeting founders who aren't in our network. But we realized that, you know, they're just pitching us. And at the end of the day, that's not that scalable, because they're going to have 20 to 50 meetings with venture capitalists. And so what we've done is gather 10 to 15 other GPs, other venture funds, to join us for those pitches. And it's a small thing, but it's one of the examples that we are doing to just try to take that friction out and really try to support founders, because there's a lot of opportunity, but it's also a really challenging time to build a business.
I'm going to take a question from Facebook. This is from Deborah Gladney. She writes, she's in Wichita, Kansas. She writes, as a Black female founder, it's great to see capital being deployed to help minority founders, but bias still exists. So what are VCs, in your case, you, what are you doing to combat the bias that we all know exists, the systemic bias?
Yeah, Deborah, that's such a great question. And one of the things that we're doing, Deborah, is taking a hard look and being intentional at the questions that we ask founders. So one of the ways that bias can show up is in the things that venture capitalists ask founders when they're in a diligence meeting. And so we've taken a really hard look at that, and have actually begun to script out the key questions that we want to cover, so that they are the same, whether it is, you know, a white woman, a Black man, a Black woman, whoever it is. And also regardless of the geography, because I have invested now both on the coast and in the middle of the country. And there's a lot of bias that we see in terms of the questions that founders from the middle of the country get asked versus founders on the coast?
Yeah, I remember we interviewed Toby Lutke of Shopify, and when he initially looked for funding, everybody told him to leave Ottawa and to move his operations to Silicon Valley, and he didn't want to.
Yeah.
It's a multi-billion dollar business today. So what advice do you have for up-and-coming entrepreneurs who are looking to pitch? What stands out to you in a pitch?
We see so many pitches, and it is hard to make a pitch stand out in this new world. And it's even harder to make a pitch stand out when you're doing it via Zoom. You don't know what the person who's watching the pitch is doing on the other end.
Yeah.
And so we encourage our founders to really invest in nailing that virtual pitch. And one thing that we really love is when founders do, you know, whether it's using Loom or some other screen recording, send us a pitch that is not just a slide deck. It's them delivering the pitch. And there's nothing better than that. You have to be charismatic. You need to get the points across. But then we hear how the founder would tell their story rather than flipping through on a static PowerPoint. So that's one way that we really encourage founders to stand out. And then it's all about running a tight fundraising process. And so being clear about who it is that you think you may be a good fit for, going after them hard and creating some urgency and momentum around the raise. Because frankly, the scarcest resource in all of this is a founder's time. Every single fundraising pitch eats up their time. It's something that we are really conscious of in our process, not to have 10 meetings with a founder because they don't have that type of time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think being protective of your time as a founder and running a tight process, getting to a quick no, if, you know, if that's what, where it's going, don't be afraid of that, but really leaning in hard to the ones where there does seem to be a fit. And then, you know, Guy, I mentioned this before, but really doing diligence on your investors. So much of the fundraising dynamic is set up for funds and GPs to diligence founders, but it really should be a two-way street because you're giving these people ownership in your company and make sure that they are willing, you know, that we, right, that we as venture capitalists are willing to work for that ownership and that we're really going to provide value.
How much of the decisions to back a company are based on your intuition and how much of it is based on like just doing the math and plugging in the numbers into a spreadsheet and looking at the result?
We look for three things when we're looking at founders. The first is a big market. We need to believe that the company is going after a big market or that they're going to create a big market. The second that we look for are evangelist customers. So we invest really early. We don't expect there to be a lot of customers, but it's easy to stand up some sort of MVP of a product, right? The first version is probably going to be ugly. It may be held together on the back end manually with a little bit of duct tape, but we like to see someone who has used the product and is wild about it. But then the third place, Guy, that we spend most of our time is on the founder and the team and getting to a place where we believe that that team is differentially suited to build this company and to be successful. So sometimes it's unique insight that they have. Sometimes it's really differentiated experience. Sometimes it's just, you know, sort of a magnetic leader that can make things happen. And that, you know, to a certain extent, that is a gut feel. But we try to put data into it. We spend a lot of time doing reference calls so that it isn't, you know, Maren and I sitting here and we have a call with someone and we have a good gut feel and we say yes. We really try to check our own gut feel and our instincts with data from people who know them well.
Great. Jennifer Neundorfer of January Ventures, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was great to be here, Guy.
That's an excerpt from my conversation with Jennifer Neundorfer, co-founder of January Ventures. To see our full interview, you can go to facebook.com/howibuiltthis. And if you want to check out other past live interviews, you can find them there or at youtube.com/NPR. This episode was produced by J.C. Howard with help from Will Mitchell, Bruce Grant, Matt Adams, Al Mannion, Gianna Capodona, John Isabella, Julia Carney, Neva Grant, and Jeff Rogers. Our intern is Farah Safari. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you in a few days. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This, Resilience Edition.
50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now I'm returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman, from Wondery. Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in our newest season, we track the power struggles within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it all says about the future and safety of artificial intelligence. Make sure to follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dives and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, Business Wars, and many more. Let me tell you, Wondery means business.